Good morning. As we tentatively put our heads out the door and raise a licked finger into the wind, just how are we doing with this whole thing, particularly in comparison with our European neighbours? Agarista Baca is with the European Centre for Disease Control, and she spoke to Brian Dobson on Thursday's Morning Ireland.
Can we say at this stage that we've now, in terms of Europe anyway, passed the peak of this infection?
What we see in the last few weeks is that almost all the countries are literally passing or have passed the peak, some of them significantly, some less. I think the last one is Poland, but almost all the EEA countries have passed it, yes.
And in terms...
However, there is a however.
Yes.
However, this does not by any means mean that the virus is gone.
Yes, and I think we'll come to that and tease out what that might mean in just a moment. But in terms of how Ireland has managed this, and it's not a competition, we should say that very clearly. But there is a question here of benchmarking, I suppose, the performance of countries in terms of the strategies that they've deployed. How has Ireland done if you look at things like rate of infection, fatalities, how our health system has coped?
I think you have done remarkably well if you compare with larger countries, of course, you have to actually, it's very difficult to compare countries because countries had different testing strategies. So we really have to find the equivalent to like apples and apples, like we say. Mm-hmm. So it's really difficult. But overall, I think really well because you had significant number of cases. But it was managed really well, we think.
Well, that is good to hear. But what about that second wave?
Our director gave an interview yesterday and she said it's a matter of when, not if. So we are expecting a second. We don't know when it will come, unfortunately.
Yes.
With the numbers we see with the antibody testing studies, we see very, very low antibody titers and percentages of antibodies in people. So we certainly think that the virus will come back.
Yeah, in that interview I see Dr. Andrea Amon. I presume that's the interview you're referring to.
Yes,
also says, she's talking to The Guardian, I think, newspaper. She said she also detects an ominous weakening in the public's resolve. People have been dealing with these restrictions and limitations on their life for a number of months now, and expecting them to continue that is quite a big ask.
It is, and with the weather getting better, we are hitting significant quarantine fatigue, like we say, or lockdown fatigue. And it's unreasonable, of course, to persuade people to stay in when there is no significant pressure on the health system anymore. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that we still need to be really vigilant. And of course, public health cannot relax during the summer.
Agarista Baca from the European Centre for Disease Control on Thursday's Morning Ireland. Later that same day, Director of the National Virus Reference Laboratory, Dr. Killian de Gascoigne, spoke to Sarah McInerney about the issue of herd immunity here in Ireland.
So if it is the case, Killian, that 250,000 people have had it roughly, or in around 5% of the population, as you say, that's pretty low, and it means most people, the vast majority of people indeed, haven't had it. Have we got this slightly wrong then? Because if I understand from what you're saying, if most people haven't had it, it can spread like wildfire through the population, or that at least would be the concern. So is there a need then for a look at a change in the strategy to allow it to spread a little more quickly around the population, or how do you address that?
The reason for, I suppose, getting that information out to is to try and, I suppose, encourage people to hold firm and stay the course with us, because we're not through this with this virus yet. But you're absolutely right. The problem is we've heard an awful lot of people a discussion in recent weeks about the concept of herd immunity in some countries allowing the virus to spread more widely. But I think we know from our own experience that if we get to a situation where we have maybe in the region of 1,000 cases per day, that will put significant pressure on our health service and will probably overwhelm our hospitals and our ICU capacity. And we know that the amount of virus in the community ultimately will have an impact on intensive care admissions and deaths. So really what we still need to do is to control the virus within the community, because ultimately that's the only way we have of saving lives at this point in time, in the absence of a vaccine, in the absence of a very effective antiviral therapy. So the options are to try and suppress it completely, which we have done to a degree, but whether we would be able to eliminate it from the island is very challenging because of our connections and the fact that we do obviously want to open up the economy at some point in the coming months.
Dr. Killian de Gascoigne with Sarah McInerney on Thursday. And virologist or not, it seems that everybody has an opinion on this. American writer Lionel Shriver spoke to Brendan O'Connor on Saturday. And Shriver being Shriver, she hasn't shied away from controversy with her views about the handling of COVID-19.
You think that this is potentially catastrophic on a scale that's bigger than anything you could ever make up. But you think that this is not a natural disaster fundamentally, but that it is a man-made one.
Yes, I think that we're in the midst of a massive worldwide overreaction to a virus that doesn't turn out to be nearly as lethal as we were afraid of to begin with. And I'm concerned about this idea of installing as a standard protocol whenever a new illness comes along, we close the country or we close the whole world. I mean, we haven't seen the whole consequence yet, but that cannot be our reaction to contagion. We're a species that has always experienced waves of infection of this, that, and the other thing, and we've got through it. What is unprecedented is not the virus, it's our reaction to it. This is new. This whole idea that you just stop everything in place and destroy your economy for weeks and therefore possibly for years or decades. I'm very concerned about young people in particular right now.
Yeah, I think we all are, Lionel. But yeah. I guess the argument is that you're saying it turns out to be less lethal than we thought. Is it not less lethal because we did shut down the economy? Because we all saw the figures for if this was allowed to rip through society, it was going to cause hundreds of thousands more deaths. So to say we shouldn't have locked down because, look, it's turned out OK, is kind of a false logic there, isn't it? It turned out OK because we locked down.
I don't think so. And that has yet to be demonstrated. Those figures that you are citing are just the product of models that are only as good as their inputs, and the inputs were incorrect. Those are inputs based on the lethality that the virus was assumed to have back when it was only in China. And it turns out that those numbers are completely false. So I don't think that the number of people who are going to end up dying is going to be appreciably different because of the lockdowns.
Writer Lionel Shriver with Brendan on Saturday. But she also spoke about her new novel, The Motion of the Body Through Space, which is about a marriage in trouble when the husband takes up running.
One of the main differences between these two characters who are spouses is their sense of proportion. And the wife, Serenata, thinks that, going for a run or doing a few press-ups, that it's a mechanical business. She compares it to vacuuming the living room rug. You know, it's a kind of housekeeping, a biological housekeeping. Whereas her husband buys into fitness as a church. It's where he finds all his meaning in life. It's his sense of purpose. It's a spiritual pursuit. I think that's where my problem is with especially the endurance sport industry. People get involved in fitness as if it's fulfilling some higher purpose that you're coming into yourself. You become this sort of Ubermenschen. It's almost Nietzschean.
Yeah.
Whereas what it really is often is an increasing narcissism, which is also increasingly unbearable to other people.
Because they do like to talk about it, don't they?
Oh, they do. And it's so boring.
Amen to that, sister. One word, triathlons. Lionel Shriver with Brendan O'Connor on Saturday. And staying with authors, on the book show Ricochet spoke to Ian Rankin. And Rankin had just celebrated his birthday with a pint in his local, the Oxford Bar in Edinburgh.
How was your pint on your birthday?
It wasn't quite a pint. It was a 330ml can of Brewdog, because that was what I had in the house. I took my special Rebus pint glass that had been made to celebrate 20 years of Rebus and stuffed them both into the pockets of my jacket, walked down completely empty city streets. It's about a 20-minute walk from my flat to the Oxford Bar. Lovely sunny day, nobody on the street at all, no traffic. Stood outside, opened the can, poured it, drank it, and then walked home briskly before the police could stop me for being too far away from my home.
Ian Rangan on the Book Show on Sunday. And Drink and the Guards was something Barry Lenehan explored on Monday's Drive Time after a pub in Donegal offered a takeaway service. Who's editor of the Donegal Daily, Stephen Maguire.
Well, in recent weeks, the bar, which is located on Buncrana's Main Street, has been offering a service they refer to as the Guinness Express. So basically, it means that people have to pay in advance for the pints of Guinness. And then at weekends, on Saturday nights, they are given pints of Guinness, delivered them by car and by bike on occasion. And the pints themselves are wrapped in cling film and delivered to your door.
The pub was visited by Gardaí on Saturday night. What happened, do we know?
The Gardaí arrived and told the cyclist that he couldn't deliver the pints of Guinness. There was a bit of a confrontation and the people behind the bar wanted to know exactly why they couldn't deliver the pints. So the people in the bar were told they couldn't deliver the pints because it was against the law that they delivered the pints and that they were breaking the law. Now, they tried to clarify which law they were breaking and they couldn't be told that then. Now, the pints were subsequently then confiscated from the bar owners.
And it was quite a significant operation, we're led to believe, as well. One undercover Garda, two patrol cars, one sergeant and one uniformed Garda at the pub.
Wigs on the green. Well, a pub offering a similar service was Hanlon's Pub in Dublin. Here's co-owner Mark Granger with Barry.
For Guinness in particular, it's important to have the normal glass you would have at the bar. But is there not a danger that it might lose some of its kick in transit?
No. The usual speed is when somebody rings in, they would get a delivery less than a half an hour after they would ring. When we'd pull the draft Guinness for them, they would be getting inside 20 minutes. So it would be okay.
In terms of getting a seal, in particular for a pint of Guinness, it makes the pint retain its head, which is also important for people as well. But if you've teamed up with a local business to get lots of different seals manufactured.
That's right, yeah. We've gone to a company down in Sandymount and they were able to make the seal for us that goes on the glass. Fits exactly dead tight onto the glass. So when you take the seal off the glass, it clicks. You can turn it upside down and not a drop will come out of it.
Fierce enterprising indeed, but is it legal? Well, here's Senior Counsel Constance Cassidy.
All the old case law says that once a contract is concluded on the licensed premises, then the delivery, i.e. the implementation of the contract, can take place by delivery.
And then Barry asked what just might be the question of the week.
What if the pints are delivered by bicycle?
I'd say Michael Collins is swivelling in his grave. That was Drive Time on Monday. And the answer, yeah, still legal. And when we look back on this time, there will be a few revealing threads. Sneaky ways to get a pint, our devotion to normal people, the chain, existential attempts at sourdough, and of course, Matt Damon. Ryan Tuberty has some rather strong feelings on the matter.
Now, another thing that's completely a myth that we can put to bed now, thanks to the constantly referred to Mr. Matt Damon, is that, and it's been doing the rounds for decades, aren't Irish people great the way they leave famous people alone? That is a lie. Irish people don't leave famous people alone. Never did, never will. Very rarely do they do that. And Matt Damon, to me, has summed it all up brilliantly. He's been a gentleman in the way he's dealt with. There's another selfie in the paper today. He did a radio interview last week and to the credit of Spin for getting that interview. Brilliant work. And he did a school graduation video for Loretto in Abbey School in Dalkey, which was very nice of him. And I just think that this idea that famous people aren't, the man has been pestered to within an inch of his life. They have hunted him down like a dog. I mean, I don't know how he's doing it. There'll be COVID memories, and this will definitely be one. When Matt Damon came to, weren't you great, very, very good to leave him alone? Hello? Yeah, Matt, can you come out to play? No, I'm trying to have it. Hello? Yeah, Matt, can you come out to play? I thought you guys were great at leaving us alone. Anyway, the tweet from Dublin Airport says that we were unable to stop Matt Damon returning to the United States if and when he chooses. That would be a repatriation journey, even though some of us would like to. We can't just keep the guy indefinitely. So that poor old Matt Damon, my heart goes out to him a little bit. When we spoke...
Yeah, heart goes out a bit, but not too much. He went to Spin. So as one texter put it...
It's all fun and games until he buys a field. Yeah, this could end badly, Matt. Be careful. This could end very badly.
Go home, Yank. Back in a bit. Welcome back. The effect of COVID-19 on the mountain gorilla was the focus of Mooney Goes Wild. Journalist Jack Losh had been in Bawindi National Park in Uganda, and how to maintain social distance from a gorilla was a question preoccupying Dr. Richard Collins.
Well, now you say you were up close and personal. Is there any remote prospect that you brought COVID-19 to the gorillas? And if you brought it, would they suffer from it?
I certainly hope that I didn't bring COVID-19 to them. But to answer your second question, yes, there is a distinct risk of that happening. Mountain gorillas share about 98% of human DNA, which makes them particularly susceptible to respiratory diseases like COVID-19. Now, since this pandemic has happened and it's sweeping increasingly through Africa, I was lucky enough to get in there just before the lockdown happened. But since then, wildlife rangers in Bwindi, in Uganda, and other surrounding national parks are taking precautions because the risks are so serious. In fact, they're so serious that scientists recently warned that if COVID-19 got into the mountain gorilla population, it would be a potential extinction level event. So what rangers are doing now, they're wearing masks, they're having to disinfect their boots, they're wearing gloves, and they have to maintain a social distance from the gorillas of 10 metres.
And with the lockdown extending to the park, this meant an abrupt end to the area's ecotourism, a massive source of income.
Western European tourists going into Uganda and Rwanda, and to a lesser extent DR Congo across the border, and paying $600 per person in Uganda, up to $1,500 in Rwanda for just an hour of the gorilla's time. That is bankrolling most of the protection and conservation of these animals. All of a sudden, that crucial source of ecotourism dollars has evaporated overnight. What this means is, right now, ranger patrols are continuing pretty much as usual, albeit with the appropriate kind of precautions like face masks and gloves. But in a few months' time, they're going to be running an empty, and it will be impossible to fund that level of protection. There's another risk as well. It's not just the gorilla conservation that depends on tourists. It's also the local communities around these national parks. So if you think that, you know, thousands and thousands of villagers are getting indirect benefits from all these tourists coming in, all of a sudden, they're no longer there and they're not spending their desperately needed money in the community. This is pushing a lot of people surrounding Bwindi and the other parks to the edge. As they run out of money, some of them will be forced to turn to the protected areas of the forest to look for bushmeat. And in fact, I was speaking to an aid worker on the ground just the other day who said, yeah, normally this time of year, you might not see any poachers for months. And in recent weeks, there's been 4 poacher arrests, which does indicate that already the strain of lockdown is beginning to bite. And normal, but, you know, poverty-stricken people who don't have any other option are now turning to the forest to survive.
So vulnerable local populations in danger of starvation, and with poachers on the rise, the very survival of the mountain gorilla is under threat. Jack Losh ended the item by recalling his encounter with some of these gorillas.
We've been trekking for a few hours through this thick, densely woven environment of kind of vines and trees and leaves. And at the time, I was trekking alongside a vet, and we were clambering down this forested ravine. When he looked at me and he knew the apes were close, he said he could even smell them. And it was at that point that the mountain gorillas came into view, high in the canopy, plucking leaves, chomping on the vegetation. Then an adult male slid down a tree, and more followed with these infants and juveniles in tow. And the icing on the cake was a huge, grunting silverback descended to join its family as all the branches buckled beneath around 400 pounds of this iconic primate. At the very end of the tour, I stepped behind to take a few more photos. Okay. By that point, the gorillas were remaining completely disinterested in these alien simians, i.e. us, the people. And as we began to depart, I saw the silverback recline on a bed of leaves, gently watching over his relatives in a landscape that for some 25,000 years hasn't changed. And today it stands as an awe-inspiring tangle of vines and creepers across this ancient rift valley. Hopefully the future of these gorillas is safe, but with the arrival of these new threats, there is still a great deal of uncertainty around their survival.
Jack Losh, as heard on Mooney Goes Wild. Over in Kerry on the South Wind Blows, Philip King brought us this.
I walked out my front door in West Kerry the other day. I live under the protective wing of Slieve Muller, Mount Eagle, and this is an approximation of the sound that I heard.
That was beautiful. That was the choir of Downside School Purley with Viola Turnard and Benjamin Britten with songs from Friday Afternoon's Opus 7, The Cuckoo. As the Green Party tussles, both internally with leadership debates and with possible government formation, the positive environmental effects of our lockdown are creating their own momentum, potentially anyway. On Drive Time, Philip Boucher-Hayes reported on our lowered emissions as a result of people staying at home.
The good news is this. In the last 3 months and over the next 3 months, decreased traffic could achieve 70% of what the entire country has to do to curb emissions to come in line with the Paris Agreement. Each year between now and 2030, we have to reduce emissions by 7% to have a shot at keeping the temperature change below 1.5 degrees. The reduction of cars and trucks on the roads alone should do much of that job this year. UCC Doctor of Engineering James Glynn has been examining the data collected by Transport for Ireland's traffic cameras.
So we're literally counting every single car that goes past those 400 cameras. So we can see the number of cars has dropped by about 85%.
It goes as low as 90% less traffic at weekends. Heavy goods vehicles are down by about 40%. Delivery vans, in spite of all of that online shopping, are down by over 50% too. James Glynn and his colleagues have done a bit of projecting into the future, presuming that traffic volumes return towards normal over the course of the next 3 months. Then they calculated what all those untravelled trips and commutes would add up to in terms of reduced emissions.
So we think it's about 1.5 million tonnes of carbon dioxide emissions.
And add in the reduction in airplane emissions and, to a lesser extent, trains. That's pretty good going. But what might we hope to take from all this? Here's Dr. Hannah Daly from UCC.
The impact of our carbon emissions on global temperatures can be pictured like pouring water into a bathtub. So the more water there is in the tub, the greater the temperature rise. So our analysis is indicating that this lockdown will slow the flow of this metaphorical water into that bathtub by about 5%. So there'll be about 5% less water going into that global atmosphere this year than there would have otherwise been.
Travelling to work and school accounts for over a third of all journeys that we take every year. Each week, the school run accounts for 7 million kilometres of driving. Commuting to work is an average of an hour a day behind the wheel of a car for most of us. That's a full working day every fortnight. That's a month. A year.
The question is, will people stand to go back to normal? So being able to work from home is a great privilege. Not everybody can do it, but many people are learning that working from home buys them more time with their family, less time in the car, less expense. And as a side benefit, there's far less traffic, less emissions, less pollution.
Drive time on Monday. And staying with drive time, Katie Hannon spoke to 7-year-old Leitrim boy Cameron Durkin. He'd received a handwritten letter from David Attenborough.
Why did you decide you wanted to finally write to him?
Because I love his programmes and he was my hero and everyone else to see.
And were you surprised when he wrote back to you?
Yeah, I nearly exploded with excitement.
I'm not surprised. And what did he say to you in the letter?
He said, "Dear Cameron, I'm happy you enjoyed my programmes. Best wishes, David Attenborough. Thanks for your letter," he said as well.
And did he write that in his own handwriting?
Yeah. He sat down at his desk and he took the time to write to poor little me.
He deserves to be your hero. There's no doubt about that.
He deserves to be everyone's hero.
Tell me, you have not eaten meat since you were 3 years old. Tell me why.
Because I love animals too much and I didn't want to hurt them.
And you've never tasted meat since then?
Nope.
And tell me, do you want to work with animals when you're grown up?
I do want to work with animals. I want to rehabilitate them back into the wild.
So what kind of animals are your favourite?
Wild dogs are one of my favourite types of dogs. My favourite animal is a leopard right now, but if you put it together and more than ever live, it's a sabretooth.
It's a sabretooth? That's an extinct animal.
I'm thinking about bringing it back to life.
And what do you think we should all be doing to help animals, to stop animals going extinct?
We should stop using fossil fuels and stop cutting down trees for firewood and palm oil. And stop getting palm oil from the trees. And we should definitely stop cutting down the forest. And stop polluting the ocean.
And Cameron helps out on a farm. And he had helped with the new lamb. And he was very excited about this.
Guess what I named the lamb.
What did you name the lamb?
Guess.
Fluffy.
No. Danger.
That is a brilliant name for a lamb.
Oh, that is very, very cute. That was Cameron Durkin with Katie Hannon on Drive Time. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now, we're all about the masks these days, but for one blind boy, when it came to his trademark plastic bag, it's a case of adapt or melt.
I've been wearing a plastic bag on my head for 15 years now. Yeah. And as I'm getting into live streaming, the thing with my plastic bag is that, first off, I have to light my face in a certain way. And the plastic bag reflects light in quite an ugly fashion. Sorry. And it, I don't, sure, look,
it's
I wear
funny,
a bag
it is
in my
funny,
head.
Yeah, it's this, funny.
It's an occupational hazard.
Yeah, yes.
So my plastic bag is reflecting the light quite right, in quite an ugly way.
Right.
And also, when I speak into the microphone, right, it makes this rustling noise, which isn't pleasant on the ear. So I've replaced my plastic bag with one that's made out of cotton. I have a custom-made cotton bag that looks like my plastic bag,
right,
which doesn't make any noise and it doesn't reflect light in an offensive fashion.
And is that, have people seen it yet?
Not yet, no. I haven't unveiled it yet. It's being made in England by a costume designer, a friend of mine who's a costume designer, and I said what I need, so I'm waiting for it in the post.
That's big news, isn't it?
No, it's currently in England in the post. It's currently in the post in England, and all posts in England is the property of the Queen.
Right.
So my new plastic bag is in the property and possession of Queen Elizabeth of England.
And are there nods to certain supermarkets in the design, or are you going with something different completely?
I always wear, my plastic bag is always, there used to be a supermarket in Swords called JC's,
yeah,
who were a family-run business. They're not around anymore, but they donated to me 10,000 plastic bags.
Right.
So it's now a cotton bag but it's a cotton replica of a plastic JC's bag from 2014. Yeah. And I'm very happy with that on ideological grounds.
Blind Boy with Ray Darcy. And staying on the topic of masks, how the airline industry is going to adapt to our new world was a question Sarah McInerney put to Ryanair Chief Executive Eddie Wilson.
Yeah, I want to ask you about face masks, actually, because I know that Michael O'Leary made a claim yesterday on BBC Radio about this. He was saying that, and I quote, face masks are effective at eliminating about 98.5% of the risk of COVID-19. Mm. He actually said that twice yesterday.
Yeah.
Now, UCD Professor Ronan Cahill has told the Business Post today that no recognised health authority stood over that 98.5% figure at this point. Why does Michael O'Leary think he knows better?
Well, I mean, it's not that Michael knows better. I mean, what you have here is that, I mean, if you look at even on RTE last week, you had Professor Luke O'Neill from Trinity College saying that wearing masks reduced by 95% the risk of the spread of the virus. Like, I don't want to get into, like, what people say their particular view is on this. There is no doubt, if you look at the World Health Organization, there's no panacea here, but there's no doubt that masks along with hand washing and good hygiene are the way to go with this.
I'm not talking about different people's views. This is Michael O'Leary, the group CEO.
Yeah, he was quoting from, there was a tweet out from the Mater, and it had, the Mater Hospital, and it had, there was some comment on that it said, and he was repeating that it said that where two people are wearing masks, that is, the basis of that is that it would eliminate it by 98.5%. And I've just given you a quote.
Eliminate what? The risk of spread? Not
the risk of spread. But like masks are only one part of it, right? There's good hand washing. There are social distancing where you can do that. But the reality is we live in urban areas. We're all making slowly post-lockdown. And you can see that people are making sensible adjustments to that. And all we're saying is that when you fly on board, our crew and our passengers will have masks. That will reduce the risk substantially, along with hand washing protocol, etc., so that we can get back to some level of normality.
But Sarah, well, she wasn't letting Michael O'Leary's comments go unchallenged.
Because I'm wondering about his approach to this, because he's made that comment about the masks, and he's also made this pretty controversial comment about Britain's plan for arriving passengers to self-isolate in their accommodation for 14 days. He said that's idiotic, effectively unenforceable. He said that there's no medical and scientific basis for it. Yes, there is, though. There is a medical and scientific basis for it.
There is, with quarantines, right? Quarantines don't work. They're unpoliceable, unimplementable. And now you have the UK government that are resiling from that, talking about air bridges this morning. There is no way that you can do that. It sounds like a good idea. But when people arrive in airports, they end up going on public transport. And what do? You take everybody who's on the Gatwick Express or the Stansted Express and isolate them as well. It doesn't work. It sounds good. What you've got to do is you've got to have sensible protocols in place. You've got to use masks on board. They have demonstrated in China, in returning to 70% of flying there, that doing temperature checks at airports, having masks on board, having masks on public transport and in shopping areas is the right way to go.
Well, I just wonder, because Britain's medical experts think they work, and our medical experts think they work. Sorry. And I just wonder what makes Michael O'Leary and indeed yourself think that you know better than the medical and scientific experts.
Directly, with respect, Michael is quoting directly from a Mater Hospital tweet.
No, I'm talking about the quarantine now.
Yeah, on quarantine, but quarantines are don't work. That's why countries around Europe are lifting them at the moment.
But they had them in place, Eddie.
Because we're in a sort of a post-lockdown where people, where governments have made sensible decisions. In Italy, they have now lifted them from June 3rd. They did that yesterday. The Spanish are doing it. The Greeks are doing it. The Portuguese have done it. The British this morning are talking about they're rolling back. First, it was the Irish were okay to go into Britain, no basis in science. Now the French were okay. Now the French aren't okay. Now what they're doing is we're going to have air bridges out of the UK. I think the quarantine, when you're talking about the movement of millions of people, trying to say that you're going to be able to police people and know that they're going to be locked down at a particular address is unimplementable.
Oh, that was quite the tussle. That was Ryanair's Eddie Wilson with Sarah McInerney. There's a new sheriff in town. Wind of Change by the Scorpions, soft rock power ballad, or a CIA plot to bring down those dirty commies.
The world is closing in. Did you ever think that we could be so close, like brothers? The future's in the air, can feel it everywhere. I'm blowing with the wind of change.
New Yorker columnist and investigative journalist Patrick Redden Keefe spoke to Sean Rocks on Arena about his podcast, which asks if the Scorpions anthem, Wind of Change, could have been created by the CIA as a propaganda tool.
There's a saying in the Irish language which goes, Dirchban lum, gnirchban lehi, which basically means, a woman told me that a woman told her. You can go on and on. And a man told her that his brother did this. And it was his uncle that actually was the source of the story in the beginning. But let's get a sense of Wind of Change itself. The song, now, you can hear it in the lyrics there. Did you ever think that we could be so close like brothers? The future's in our hands, you know, can feel it everywhere. Take me to the magic of the night. All of, you know, we're looking at very exciting events. How important was it, and how linked was it, in fact, to the reunification of Germany?
Well, so the song, to get into the specifics of the song, it was written actually before the wall came down, but it wasn't released until afterwards. So the band, the Scorpions, had gone and played in Moscow in the summer of 1989. Which was quite a big thing because rock and roll had effectively been banned in the Soviet Union during the Cold War. There was a sense that the Kremlin had that it was quite dangerous to communist control, and obviously very associated with the West. But there was a bit of opening up, and the band had gone to Moscow in the summer of 89. And then after that, they record this song. And the song becomes kind of an anthem for the reunification of Germany, but then also very, very influential among young people in the Soviet Union. And it kind of spreads like wildfire. It goes to number one on the charts all across Europe in 91, and really is the soundtrack, you know, once the wall has fallen, to the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So it was, for me, looking into it, it actually makes a certain amount of sense that it would dovetail with US interests.
And far from being the crazed notion of the bedroom conspiracy theorists, this was kind of plausible.
This is one of these funny stories where the more I dug into it, you would have thought the less plausible it would seem. But the more I dug, the more plausible it seemed. And so some of it is the kind of thing you're getting at, where it turns out Klaus Meine, who wrote the song, didn't usually write songs. This was quite different, in fact, than all the other songs that the Scorpions had been writing for years. They weren't really a political band per se. They were kind of a, you know, an 80s hair metal act with all the preoccupations that would imply. And suddenly they go political, and they record the album for the first time in the States with an American producer. And so it was that kind of thing where, as I looked into it, and also as I looked into the history of the CIA, you know, initially I thought, what could they ever have to do with music? But of course, it turns out the CIA was very active during the Cold War in promoting certain types of culture because they thought that it would be a threat to Soviet ideology.
The Scorpions themselves have denied any CIA involvement whatsoever. So Sean returned to his original line of questioning and put it to Keefe that his key source, CIA agent Michael, might have been pulling his leg.
Coming back to my Dirchban Lum, Gnirchban Lehi theory, and I know you touch on this in the podcast as well, but your friend Michael, I mean, you, let's face it, Patrick, have dealt with the intelligence community in the past, and you've investigated the intelligence community in the past in your very serious investigative journalism work. What if the CIA, in fact, said to Michael, who is a CIA operative for this, for these purposes, do you know what we need you to do now? Would you get to that Keefe guy? Would you get him off our backs? Would you lead him up some, you know, wild, on some big
Go goose chase. Oh, look, tell him that wind of change. Tell him we wrote that. Yeah. Tell him the CAA wrote that, and get him to spend 10 years working on that. That'll occupy him for a while. Do you think there's a possibility that your friend
Believe me, the thought has occurred to me. I mean, this is the thing: once you open the door to this kind of thinking, then anything's possible. And part of what I was trying to capture in the podcast, hopefully in a fun way, is that it's all a bit of a hall of mirrors, right? Once you start asking these questions, it could be that, you know, yeah, that somebody got to Michael and Michael's telling me stories, or somebody got to Oliver and Oliver's telling Michael stories, or somebody got to the guy who told the story to Oliver. And you just begin to question everything and wondering, you know, always, who's the secret agent in the room?
Matt Damon, of course. That was Patrick Redden-Keefe with Sean Rocks on Arena. Yesterday, Ryan Tuberty spoke to comedian and best-selling children's author David Walliams, and he spoke about being a reluctant reader.
How did you go from reluctant reader to the guy who just realised, actually, this is what I want to do and read?
Well, I was lucky enough to find a book that I really loved, and that was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory by Roald Dahl. And my parents used to take me and my sister to our local library every couple of weeks, and I'd get out books on dinosaurs and the solar system and look at the pictures and do a little bit of reading, but I never really got stuck into a book in a big way until I read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and then that put me in the path of reading, and you don't become a writer unless you like reading. So I think it's just about finding the right book, and I just try and make my books as like entertaining and fun as possible. Mm. And I wrote these books called The World's Worst Children, which are like full of pictures and short stories. And having been to schools and meeting the kids who are reluctant readers, I'm thinking, I want to write a book especially for them, because actually they're the ones you need to reach. Because you'll meet an 8-year-old who's read all the Harry Potter books,
yeah,
and you'll meet a 12-year-old who hasn't read a book ever. So kind of like, if you don't get that 12-year-old soon, they're probably going to grow up having never read a book. And that's a shame, because books can offer something really special.
And then fellow writer 11-year-old Alex from Waterford phoned in.
What do you write?
I write comics, The Adventures of Foxman, or just Foxman.
It's Foxman? Is he a character you invented yourself?
Yeah.
And can you tell me about him?
Yeah. He's originally a boy called John Jay, and he got bitten by a radioactive fox on the leg, and whenever he scratches his leg, he turns into Foxman and, like, beats up the baddies and stuff.
David, that is
That's brilliant. Isn't that, you know, great? I think I might call my next book Foxman. It's about a man.
What's it about, David?
By a radioactive fox,
really?
On the leg.
Yeah.
This is such a great idea.
I know, it's amazing. And you know what? The word plagiarism is very hard to spell. So I think you could get away with it.
It's a brilliant idea. I love it. It's fantastic. Actually, Fox is a great character to be, isn't it? Because. Yeah. Foxes are quite mysterious, aren't they? And they can sneak about and hide in corners and live in burrows and stuff. Yeah, fantastic.
Fantastic is right. That was David Walliams with Alex from Waterford with Ryan yesterday. We are almost at a finish here on Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
Oh, you crawled out of the sea, straight into my arms, straight into my arms. Oh, you crawled out of the sea, straight into my arms, straight into my arms. Oh, you crawled out of the sea, straight into my arms.